Welcome to On Air, a podcast discussion at the intersection of artificial intelligence and international relations, where we will discuss the development of IR theory, law, and practice in the age of AI.
Hello, and welcome to the IR in the Age of AI podcast. I'm your host, Midlir Mema. We have heard a lot about the EU AI Act. Here in our program, we have tried to cover it. However, today we're privileged to actually have with us Luca Pertuzzi, a Brussels-based journalist who, by all accounts, is perhaps the one person who knows perhaps even better than the EU officials themselves and state leaders, government leaders, the ins and outs of the negotiations surrounding the EU AI Act. Luca, welcome to On Air.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, and I'm really excited. I know you're really busy, so I really appreciate you making some time for us today. Luca, first, maybe a few words about yourself, and then let's delve into the act.
Sure. So I've been a tech journalist for the past 3 years. I was technology editor at Euractiv, where I oversaw a team of four reporters based in Paris, Brussels, and Berlin. And I was also reporting on the AI Act, following every twist and turn from the very presentation of the file up until the end.
Okay. Thank you. And now let's turn our attention a little bit, as I said, to the EU AI Act. Now, about a third of our listeners live within EU borders. The other two-thirds are elsewhere in Asia and the United States. Mm-hmm. So two related questions. One is, what is the EU AI Act? To cover it briefly. And then second, why should the rest of the world care?
Sure. So the EU AI Act is the first sort of horizontal rules on artificial intelligence. You might say that it's not the first AI rulebook because China has passed already some laws, but they followed a completely different approach because they went vertical. Right. Whereas the EU has adopted horizontal legislation, which is based on traditional product safety rules that are typical of the EU consumer protection approach to technology. So what is the AI Act? It basically defines several levels of risks and regulates accordingly. So the highest level is considered non-acceptable risk, and this includes applications that basically are deemed not to be compatible with European values, like social scoring, manipulative techniques, predictive policing, and certain uses of emotion recognition. Then there are high-risk applications, which are basically AI in specific sectors that are deemed to be particularly consequential for people's lives. If you take, for example, a software that is used to decide whether or not you should get access to social services or whether or not you should get a job, you want these systems to be absolutely robust and to follow certain due diligence obligations in terms of data management and risk assessment and transparency. Then there are certain more specific risks, like if you take generative AI, for example, there will be some transparency that the users need to be aware that content has been generated by a machine and not by a human. And then there are the low-risk applications that basically have no rules if you take the spam filter of your mailbox, for example. So this is in a nutshell. Now, why should you care about this? Well, right. Since it's the first legislative intervention in this area, it's bound to be quite seminal. And when you're a good student, you probably want to copy the homework of people that did something before you. And the EU has proven its capacity to set the global benchmark in the digital policy area with the General Data Protection Regulation that has been followed by jurisdictions worldwide. And what we are likely to see is that the AI Act will provide the blueprint for similar regulatory efforts in other jurisdictions too. For example, in Canada, there is legislation that is looking closely at the AI Act. So it might be a European development, but it actually might have global implications for also what is known as this Brussels effect. Namely, will companies adapt their products only for the European market and have different level of security and safety for other markets, or will they opt to have all the same level of security for all their products? And there is an argument for both sides, but I think it will still be relevant, and companies and developers will still have to take into account the European rules, because of course it's one of the largest markets out there.
Okay, wonderful. There are some, and I remember having guests here in the past that mentioned, made that argument with regards to GDPR and drew parallels between GDPR and the EU AI Act. But there was some doubt that perhaps in the case of the EU AI Act, the biggest impact and perhaps a negative impact would be on EU businesses. At least that was the initial kind of like impression. That was the initial narrative. I know that the Bloomberg just had actually also just released an article where they were just saying, okay, goodbye to the billions of dollars that you'd have gotten out of this innovative period, that somehow this act would stifle competition. Mm-hmm. Is that your sense? What do you say to those who are skeptical about the impact of AI Act in terms of its economic result?
Well, I haven't seen Bloomberg's report on this, but indeed there are some economic assessments, even the Commission's own assessment that estimates the compliance cost for high-risk applications to be in the order of the 200,000-300,000 euros to set up a quality management system, and then around 70,000-80,000 euros for yearly maintenance.
Yeah.
So, of course, if you are a startup in the early stage, this is all money that you have to spend on compliance,
right,
rather than to throw it on growth. But there is a but. First of all, there is more legal certainty,
right,
because with new technologies, you also need to know what are the boundaries. Secondly, the idea is to increase consumer trust. And if there is more trust, people will use this technology more. And a third aspect that we are beginning to see just now that the AI Act is almost law is that this is becoming, let's say, more general framework that investors and companies that are looking, or organizations more broadly, are looking to use these AI tools. Basically, they are requiring a due diligence framework that is based on the AI Act. So if you're a company and you're acquiring an AI tool, you want to be sure that the risk is limited. And so how do you ensure that? If you're an investor and you want to make sure that you're not buying into a startup that might have some serious repercussion on your reputation later. Now, the big question on that is, of course, that the bulk of the rules are on these high-risk applications. So there might be an economic incentive to underestimate what is high-risk. So is my company producing a high-risk software or not? Of course, startups often need money immediately. Right. And so they probably see the risk of underestimating the level of risk lower than being fined later. So right. How investors and so on will assurance companies too will look at this new reality, it's a question mark. I think there are B2B solutions that are already developing in this area. And I think there will be a whole market developing in terms of AI and safety and audits, assessments of risk. So it's also it's also a market in itself.
Right. But of course, those are added costs for businesses. And then you add on top of that the 35 million euro or 7% of global annual revenue, whichever is higher fee or fine, rather, if you do not abide by those regulations. Then again, you can understand how, like you said, a startup or even a small business that has been around for a little bit may actually find this to be quite onerous. On this issue, I think a lot...
Perhaps, go ahead. This is for high-risk applications.
Right.
And
do you want to explain what that is? I think you mentioned this earlier in passing, clarify that.
There are a list of areas that are deemed high-risk. So employment, education, social services, law enforcement. These will all be under a more rigid regime. But no one obliges a company to develop a solution on these areas. Yeah. And if you talk to a regulator, they will tell you, well, look, if you want to come up with a product, you need to make sure it's safe.
Yeah.
And so if you don't have a business model to ensure it's safe, maybe you shouldn't be in business.
Yeah. But here's this is a related question here, because oftentimes we jokingly perhaps refer to European Union, to the EU, as an area of that is highly regulated. Of course, it's a norm setter globally, but not one that encourages local, so to speak, innovation. How well positioned are EU companies to compete in the global market? I mean, putting aside perhaps the EU AI Act, because everybody in the EU zone will have to comply with them. So there's a level playing field in a way. But how do you see the AI market in Europe in terms of companies that are emerging?
Yeah, of course, I'm more focused on the AI policy side of things. But as I said, I do see a trade-off between rules and innovation, perhaps not to the extent some private actors claim, but there are, of course, the compliance costs that need to be taken into account.
Yeah.
But whether these rules stifle innovation, I would say, well, it's not the AI Act that will prevent the emergence of leading AI companies in Europe. Europe has bigger problems in terms of a fragmented single market with labor laws that make it very difficult to hire people in a different European country, different administrative procedure, tax procedure. A lot of startups that I meet, they tell me that it's easier, European startups, they tell me it's easier for them to go scale up in the US and then come back to the European market. And this is not,
it's not ideal.
EU rules. Actually, EU rules prevent that every member state come up with a different legal framework and further fragmentation. So I think there are other policies that could be taken to favor the emergence of European technology companies, starting from the Capital Markets Union.
Wonderful. Thank you. Let's jump for a second. In a way, it's a continuation of our discussion on the high-risk kind of applications of AI. You were mentioning that most of these kind of like stiff rules are in the area of education, law enforcement, employment, which, by the way, are the most profitable, the possible avenues for the future. And so that's, again, that raises some questions about the EU AI Act itself, its impact in the future. But there's been a lot of, at least the initial reaction from civil society, non-government organization groups, has been mixed, to say the least, if not perhaps openly critical. I have in mind here, for example, Laura Cabrera of the Center for Democracy and Technology, Article 19, an NGO that looks at the issues of civil liberties, the Protect Not Surveil Coalition, all of which have come out, again, initially, yes, expressing some support, but also expressing disappointment that there were a lot of loopholes when it comes to the use of AI by law enforcement, especially. Many of these organizations called for a total ban on targeted facial recognition by law enforcement. There were some initial, there were some rumors that the EU would take this into account. However, by the estimates of these organizations, at least, I'd like you to perhaps clarify that they feel this remote facial recognition, the ability of law enforcement organizations to do this, undermines the civil liberties, and especially in the area of, again, poor areas or with migrants. What's your assessment of that? Do they have a case?
Well, look, I think what we're talking about here are two essential tensions in that are as old as human society,
right.
The need for security and the need for freedom. And the member states, so European governments, especially those that are dealing with terrorism, organized crimes, they prioritize giving tools to law enforcement to fight this phenomenon.
What countries are those? Could you perhaps point to
France,
a few of them?
Italy, Spain are traditionally on the law enforcement side of things. Germany, not anymore since they changed government.
Well, I assume Germany, because of its past, perhaps would have also some would be allergic to great surveillance to that issue.
Yes. Is
this about the threat of terrorism, or is it also about migrants coming from Middle East and North Africa?
Of course, migration is also, especially in Central Eastern Europe, it's a big topic, of course. So by contrast, the majority of members of the European Parliament that are directly elected by European citizens, they oppose giving too much leeway to police forces for fear of abuses, and they prioritize civil liberties for citizens. And these also NGOs, they play this every stakeholder plays a role. So politics is also about compromise. You could say that from the civil liberties perspective, the AI Act does not go far enough. The other side would probably say the opposite. I think the final results is still better than the status quo.
Okay, well, thank you. So as we prepare to wrap up here, a couple of things. Now, like I introduced in the beginning as, I think, the Mr. EU AI Act, in a way. I know that also government officials held you in high regard for your reporting, and I think your really intrepid just kind of investigation of this whole thing. And I know you knew the ins and outs of this. Did anything surprise you as you looked at the where sausage was being made, in a way? Did anything surprise you or disappoint you or whatever? What did you find particularly interesting?
Well, we haven't even mentioned the foundation models struggle. I think that was a bit the surprise during the negotiations, how basically France and Germany, and to a lesser extent Italy, they turn against the rules on foundation models because of a couple of European companies that were pushing against them.
Right. So this is with regards to generative AI models, ChatGPT-like.
ChatGPT, and not only ChatGPT, but also the underlying foundation models, which would be GPT-4. Right. So I think this was, at least for me, the first time I saw company completely taking over the position of a country. And of course, in Brussels, the biggest lobbies are member states, the most powerful lobbies, and they are basically the shareholders of the European project.
Right.
So that was quite a development, and I think it went very close to killing the whole legislation.
Well, so there is one of the issues that's come up with regards to that, with regards to generative AI. My understanding is that for much of that application is not going to be, it's not a high-risk one. It's been lower in terms of the implications for it, that the applications of generative AI are not categorized generally as high-risk, which means that you also have a lower threshold that you have in terms of the assessments. Is that a correct assessment?
Yeah, so there are two things about that. First of all, if you take ChatGPT, okay, so ChatGPT is not high-risk by default.
Right.
But if my company takes ChatGPT and turns it into a chatbot to select personnel, say it makes the first screening talking
for HR,
and for HR purposes, and then says you're fit, you're not fit, that is an high-risk application, and that would need to follow the due diligence obligations, and OpenAI as the provider of ChatGPT would have to provide all the relevant information for my company to comply with the AI Act. The other thing to say is that the foundation models, so GPT-4 that underpins ChatGPT, have been regulated. So the approach here was to introduce some horizontal rules in terms of transparency for all of these foundation models. For instance, how much energy you use to train the model, if you use copyright material to train it, and so on. And then there is a second layer of foundation models deemed to have a systemic risk for society.
Right.
I think at the moment, GPT-4 is the only one, or maybe there are a couple that fit into this category. And these will have to follow some specific requirements in terms of managing risk and they will have to keep regulatory dialogue with the Commission to ensure that these risks are managed effectively.
Now, on this, we keep on just going off, but I think this is valuable. It's important. Now, with regards to what you just mentioned about foundational models and the impact and the point that you're saying that the private company, if they were applying ChatGPT-like new models for hiring practices, that they would be subject to this high-risk evaluation. My understanding is that the fundamental rights impact assessments don't necessarily apply equally to private sector decision-making and applications as they do the public sector ones, which for me, at least what that would mean is that even though this would be evaluated as a high-risk application, there is not necessarily a direct obligation on the part of these private companies to actually to run a thorough fundamental rights impact assessment. Am I right on that or am I wrong?
Yeah. So maybe let me just clarify. So
yeah, thank you.
The requirements on high-risk AI systems are on the provider of that system. Okay. So the company.
Even if the application is solely in the private sphere?
Yes. Okay. Yes. The fundamental rights impact assessment is on the user. So the user, if public body uses an AI for a high risk, say, as I was saying, to decide whether you should get social housing or not, they should conduct this fundamental rights impact assessment to consider, well, is there a risk of discriminating people of color or of certain socioeconomic background? This is limited to public sector bodies and to private organizations that provide public services, like a private school or a private hospital. So yeah, this is only referring to the user of that high-risk system.
Okay, thank you. Here's then my last final question. It's about blind spots. If we look at the AI Act in terms of entry into force, so I think we understand that much of this will be registered by May or June of 2024. And then most of its provisions will probably become applicable only after a 2-year period. But then you have provisions that have to do with prohibited AI systems that will probably have to apply immediately, meaning within a 6-month period. And then most of the provisions with regards to generative AI, perhaps by some estimates, will apply perhaps after a 12-month period. 2 years ago, nobody spoke about generative AI. Nobody knew what generative AI was. You did, but most people had no idea. And nobody really could anticipate that really that would be our main interface with AI. We were looking at different kind of questions, different applications, and all of a sudden ChatGPT 3.5 kind of blew up in November. And everybody now knows, and that's their interaction with AI. Mm-hmm. And I suspect the negotiations shifted once, of course, this ChatGPT came and blew up. Considering that there is this lag time between the law and the application, what do you think are some of the blind spots that, and I'm sure that there were conversations also between the various member states and stakeholders, as you put it. What do you think are the blind spots here? What are the things that we have not considered, or we have considered, but we are not prepared for? And do you think the act will be any good, let's say, 2 years from now?
Well, that's really the million-dollar question. Just to give you an idea, when I started covering this act, it was when it was first proposed in April 2021.
Yeah.
And then the narrative was like, what are you doing? This is a technology that is not mature yet. This is like an overkill. And then after ChatGPT was released, the narrative was, you're not going fast enough, you're not keeping up with the technology, now it's too late. So people will always find reason to complain. That's right. The first takeaway. And the second one is, of course, the AI Act is pretty much written in the sand, because this is a technology that changes every 6 months. Right. In Brussels, there is a buzzword that everything needs to be future-proof. Right. Well, the AI Act was not even passed that it was already made outdated by ChatGPT, and it had to rethink the whole technology neutral approach.
Right.
So I think a lot of how the AI Act will be remembered, if it will be a success story or not, will come down to the governance and enforcement, and how much the Commission will be able to have the pulse of the market and the technological developments and adapt the provisions accordingly. There is scope to do that. There is a scientific panel, there is an advisory forum. So there are all the tools for the Commission to keep up. The question will be, as always, resources, because then that's a big budgetary constraint in the EU institutions. And resources might also mean that, to save time, the Commission is just sitting in a corner doing its own thing and not talking to stakeholders. And that's perhaps the biggest risk right now, that they think they are self-sufficient and don't go out there and speak to people that probably know better than them what is going on. And I won't say I'm one of them. There are people much more aware of me about how the market is developing. But I would say, like, if there is one thing to be done to make sure that AI Act stays relevant, is to keep your eyes open and your door open to speak to stakeholders, civil society, academics, and investors too, because actually those are the people that know best where the market is going or might go.
Okay. Well, Luca, thank you so much. You've been very generous with your time. I really appreciate your insights. Look forward to perhaps having you, and as we follow this issue, having you back in the future. And of course, thank you to all our listeners. As always, if you like the show, we invite you to subscribe and leave us a comment. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Also, don't forget to join us for the next episode for a discussion at the intersection of artificial intelligence and international relations theory, law, and practice. Until then, stay human.